Emery, and this is For the Record program number 346, Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire, Part 3, Nation Building by the Underground Reich. This is being recorded on February 3rd of the year 2002, and this is going to continue with discussion and, more specifically, analysis of the events in and around and attendant upon the terrorist blitzkrieg of September 11th, 2001. In the two preceding broadcasts in this sequence, I advanced my working hypothesis that not only are the political, economic, domestic, and foreign policy aspects of the September 11th, 2001 attacks inextricably linked, they in turn are linked to the political theories of, among others, Karl von Clausewitz, the Prussian military theoretician, or that convergence is linked to that. But I have continued with my analysis of the attacks as basically a fusion of the attack on Pearl Harbor, in effect, literally a sneak attack upon the sovereign nation of the United States of America by a hostile, foreign, fascist power, what I call the Underground Reich. And I am also analyzing this as a Reichstag fire, as what at another level of analysis could be considered an act intended to provoke a predetermined response in the United States, which would hand political, economic, fascist control to an American political leadership clique, which I believe to be a direct extension of the Underground Reich. Quite literally, a Third Reich gone underground and perpetuated in mafia-like fashion, utilizing not only the consummate economic power of the Martin Bormann outfit that I've spoken about so many times in the past, but also the political and national security connections of, among other institutions, the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that we incorporated at the end of World War II, and the institution that to a large extent managed that, and that was Heinrich Mueller's worldwide intelligence outfit. Heinrich Mueller, the head of the Gestapo, who ran the security outfit for Martin Bormann. There are many For the Record programs dealing with this subject material, plus archive shows available from Spitfire. In particular, I refer listeners who are going to pursue this information to RFA Show 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. More information about where you can learn more about this on websites later in the program. Now, we're going to review some information by way of setting the groundwork for discussion of nation building in the United States by the Underground Reich, bearing in mind both the economic power of what I call the transatlantic industrial and financial fascist axis. This is the industrial and financial milieu that not only helped to finance Hitler, but which in turn became inextricably linked with the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization, literally a Third Reich gone underground at the end of World War II. In 1994, St. Martin's Press published a remarkable book with an unfortunate title. That book is called The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by former professional military officer and Justice Department investigator John Loftus and his co-author Mark Ahrens. Loftus ran the Justice Department unit that was investigating the importation of Nazi war criminals at the end of World War II. He had a very high security clearance, and in addition to a tremendous amount of academic research, Loftus had power of attorney for a group of former American, British, and Soviet intelligence agents who got permission from a good guy faction inside of the CIA to publish their remarkable story of what had happened in the 20th century on condition of anonymity. The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, is the result of the remarkable efforts of Loftus and Ahrens. Now, of the connections between the Bush family, specifically George W.'s great-grandfather, George Herbert Walker, one of Hitler's three earliest financial backers and the man whose last name W. carries as a middle name, and also his grandfather, Prescott Bush Sr., George Walker's son-in-law, George Herbert Walker's son-in-law, who was a partner with George Herbert Walker and his Nazi front companies, specifically the Union Banking Corporation, whose post-war liquidation provided the foundation for the Bush family fortune, and also the Hamburg America line, which became a key element of the Bormann organization in the post-war period. Now, we're going to take a look at the masking of these Nazi assets, that done by Alan Dulles, the Sullivan and Cromwell operative who was a key U.S. intelligence agent from the 1920s right on up through his tenure at the CIA. He also helped to oversee the American investments in pre-Nazi and Nazi Germany. Of the masking of the Bush family Nazi assets by Alan Dulles, Loftus and Ahrens write, speaking here of Prescott Bush Sr., W.'s grandfather, instead of divesting the Nazi money, Bush hired a lawyer to hide the assets. The lawyer he hired had considerable expertise in such underhanded schemes. It was Alan Dulles. Once the government had its hands on Bush's books, the whole story of the intricate web of Nazi front corporations began to unravel. A few days later, two of Union Banking's subsidiaries, the Holland American Trading Corporation and the Seamless Steel Equipment Corporation, also were seized. Then the government went after the Harriman 15 Holding Company, which Bush shared with his father-in-law, Bert Walker, the Hamburg America Line, and the Silesian American Corporation. The U.S. government found that huge sections of Prescott Bush's empire had been operated on behalf of Nazi Germany and had greatly assisted the German war effort. Of course, this Bush entrepreneurship was ultimately led to the post-war liquidation of the Union Banking Corporation, which provided the foundation for the Bush family's post-war business ventures. And the Bush family ventures were in partnership with the Thiessen family. That was one of the primary elements of the financial underpinnings of Hitler and also one of the key elements in the Bormann organization, the post-war underground Reich that we've spoken about in the past. Reviewing another element that we've looked at from the secret war against the Jews, this places Alan Dulles with British fascist and intelligence agent turncoat Jack Philby at the genesis of Saudi Arabia. These two men helped to elevate King Ibn Saud into the throne of what became Saudi Arabia and to corral the petroleum assets for the Third Reich, American oil, and the Underground Reich. Bear in mind that Ibn Saud was a close friend of Mohammed bin Laden, who basically acquired a construction monopoly in Saudi Arabia. So the genesis of the bin Laden family economic empire, is at this very same nexus. Turning to the discussion of Philby and Dulles' elevation of Ibn Saud, we read once again from the secret war against the Jews. Speaking of Jack Philby, the renegade British intelligence agent plucked an obscure terrorist out of the desert and helped to make him the king of Saudi Arabia. Ibn Saud was very much his creation. Philby stole the information from British intelligence files that engineered Saudi control over the holiest shrines of the Muslim world. Jack Philby and Ibn Saud betrayed the British Empire and made the American oil companies economic masters of the region. The man who helped them do it was Alan Dulles, an American spy who had befriended Philby while he was coordinating American intelligence gathering in the Middle East in the first half of the 1920s. Between them, these three men built the very foundations of the modern Middle East. They were the architects of the oil weapon, the instigators of war, the manipulators of history. More important, Philby's and Ibn Saud's political and philosophical allegiance was to Nazi Germany, while much of Dulles' profits came from the same source. Note that last sentence. More important, Philby's and Ibn Saud's political and philosophical allegiance was to Nazi Germany, while much of Dulles' profits came from the same source. What we're going to look at now is a post-World War II instance of nation-building in the United States by some of these same elements, utilizing a key intelligence component of what I call the Underground Reich, namely some of the Nazi and Eastern European fascist collaborators of the Third Reich that were inextricably linked with the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that was glommed onto the CIA. And in turn, we're going to take a look at an altogether illegal domestic intelligence operation which took place in the United States. This was a joint CIA State Department operation called the Crusade for Freedom. in which many of these Nazi and Eastern European fascist collaborators, war criminals of the highest order in many cases, were brought into the United States to become leaders in the large Eastern European ethnic communities in the United States. This was seen as being essential to political nation building in the United States because it was the Republicans' view that the 1948 victory by Truman over Dewey was because of the, quote, Jewish vote, unquote, and they wished to turn the Eastern European ethnic communities in urban America rightward in order to basically bolster the fortunes of the Republican Party. Now, the person who oversaw this operation was Alan Dulles. The person who, in turn, helped to supervise the Crusade for Freedom, again, a domestic nation-building operation by elements of U.S. intelligence with some of these transatlantic financial and industrial connections. And this, in turn, was accomplished in combination with the underground Reich. The person who oversaw the Crusade for Freedom was Richard Nixon at the behest of Alan Dulles, turning to secret war against the Jews. With the help of the Dulles-Angleton clique, the Vatican had sent many of the Eastern European Nazis to Western countries, including the United States, Australia, and Canada, where the right wing recruited them to get out the rest of the Eastern European ethnic vote. The man who ran the political recruitment campaign in the United States was Richard Nixon. We're going to take a look at some of the people who worked on the Dulles-Nixon project. Turning again to the secret war against the Jews, and again this operation was called the Crusade for Freedom. As a young movie actor in the early 1950s, Ronald Reagan was employed as the public spokesperson for an OPC front named the Crusade for Freedom. Reagan may not have known it, but 99% of the Crusade's funds came from clandestine accounts which were laundered through the Crusade to various organizations such as Radio Liberty, which employed Dulles' fascists. William Casey, who later became CIA director under Ronald Reagan and managed the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign, also worked in Germany after World War II on Dulles' Nazi Freedom Fighters program. When he returned to New York, Casey headed up another OPC front, the International Rescue Committee, which sponsored the immigration of these fascists to the United States. Casey's committee replaced the International Red Cross as the sponsor for Dulles' recruits. And then the sources for that information are listed. Now, taking a look at an element of this nation building in the United States, the Crusade for Freedom, one of the elements that was brought into the United States in order to help to specifically counteract the quote, Jewish influence, unquote, in the New York, New Jersey area was a unit called the Vorkommando Moscow. The Vorkommando Moscow was an SS intelligence unit inextricably linked with the Holocaust, and that entire SS intelligence unit was brought into the United States and resettled complete and intact in the New York, New Jersey area as part of this nation building. Turning once again to the Lawfus Aaron's text, Vorkommando Moscow was an elite forward unit of SS intelligence on the Soviet front. Its primary mission was anti-communist intelligence collection, but it also was responsible for security screening of the occupied populations in a broad sector of the Eastern Front, which held nearly 6 million Jews. Precisely this security and intelligence experience made the men of the unit so attractive to Western intelligence after the war, and led them to their journey to the United States and membership in Nixon's Republican ethnic groups, unquote. Vorkommando Moscow did not kill the Jews. It hired the collaborators who recruited the executioners who killed the Jews. From 1940 to 1942, this one small unit acted as an employment agency for the architects of Nazi genocide in Eastern Europe. Contrary to popular belief, while the Germans masterminded and controlled the machinery of the Holocaust, the foot soldiers who carried it out were not primarily Germans, but local volunteers from Poland, the Baltic states, Ukraine, and White Russia. Those non-Germans who wished to serve Hitler's new order first had to pass a security check by Vorkommando Moscow. And I would note that the commander of this unit had been Franz Alfred Sieks, an SS brigadier general, who had in turn been sprung from the defendant's dock at Nuremberg, and he later was involved in helping to set up the U.S. Special Forces, originally under CIA and State Department auspices. We look at that in RFA program number one. And we're going to take a look now at the role, and bear in mind that this was an SS intelligence unit brought into the United States for the purposes specifically, explicitly, of nation building. We're going to take a look now at the incorporation of this into the Republican Party under Richard Nixon's presidency and by the elder George Bush, who later became director of the CIA, who was chairman of the Republican National Committee at this time. Turning once again to the secret war against the Jews, although our intelligence sources are not unanimous on this point, several say that George Bush was included among the handful of people who knew about Nixon's deal to bring the fascist groups into the Republican Party in 1972. Indeed, since Bush was the head of the National Committee, he was in the best position to supervise the transfer of the campaign staff's ethnic fascists into the Republican Party's own organization. A 1976 memo to Republican National Committee co-chairman Robert Carter contains an even more damning implication. During Bush's time as Republican National Committee chairman, he appointed Colonel J. Nimchick as director of the party's ethnic heritage groups. Nimchick's memo to Robert Carter praised Bush as having, quote, added needed strength and impetus, unquote, to the Republicans' ethnic recruitment effort. Nimchick reported that Bush, quote, had full knowledge of, and in the words of the memo, provided total support for the party's ethnic heritage groups. This basically was the incorporation of the Crusade for Freedom alumni into the Republican Party as a formal wing of the Republican Party. Bear in mind that Nixon oversaw that importation. The allegedly unknowing frontman for that was Ronald Reagan. It was Ronald Reagan's CIA director and 1980 campaign director, William Casey, who handled the State Department machinations to bring these people in. Turning again to the Loftus Aaron's text. In 1972, Nixon appointed George Bush as head of the Republican National Committee. It was Bush who fulfilled Nixon's promise to make the ethnic emigre a permanent part of Republican politics. Skipping down. Nearly 20 years later, and after exposés in several respectable newspapers, Bush continued to recruit most of the same ethnic fascists, including Laszlo Pastor, for his own 1988 ethnic outreach program when he first ran for president. What we're going to do now is to move from the past to the present, and we're going to take a look at the younger George Bush's political utilization of the September 11th attacks. And I'm going to be advancing what is, yes, a conspiracy theory, and just as I've indicated that the political, economic, military, foreign policy, and domestic policy aspects of this event are inextricably linked, and just as I have been asked whether this was, in my opinion, a Pearl Harbor or a Reichstag fire, I believe it is both, as I indicated earlier in the program. We're going to turn now to the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, January 29th of the year 2002, and we're going to listen to what some of the heirs of Ibn Saud have been up to, or at least what some of their subordinates have been up to. This again from the Chronicle of January 29th, a Tuesday of 2002. This is by Carl Nolte of the Chronicle. It's headlined, Detainees Are Mostly Saudis. Subtitled, Kingdom Asks U.S. to Hand Them Over. A report that about 100 of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban detainees being held in Cuba are Saudi Arabian citizens raised new complications for the Bush administration yesterday over what to do with the men accused of terrorism. Quote, I'll listen to all the legalisms and announce my decision when I make it, unquote, President Bush said in a White House appearance with Afghan interim leader Hamid Karzai. Bush's words were apparently designed to tamp down questions over the legal status of the detainees captured in Afghanistan, especially by Secretary of State Colin Powell. Powell indicated that he wanted the administration to consider giving the captured men, turning to the inside page, safeguards under the Geneva Convention. The Saudi government said yesterday that more than 100 of the 158 detainees are Saudi citizens, and it wanted the U.S. to hand them over for questioning. George Bush said he would give that some consideration. I would note that as I'm recording this on February 3rd of the year 2002, this past week, George Bush named Iran, Iraq, and North Korea as the axis of evil. Pointedly left out was Saudi Arabia and the economic leverage of the Saudis through A, petroleum, B, the reinvestment of petrodollars into the U.S. economy, and C, through their holding of U.S. foreign debt. The influence of the Saudis is profound. We're going to be taking a look later on in this program at some of the Bush family investments with the Saudis, including some that we have not touched on before. Again, I think the relative grace with which George Bush is handling the Saudis, the heirs to Ibn Saud, is not at all coincidental. We're going to turn now to an article from the New Yorker magazine of October 22nd of 2001. This was posted on the web on October 16th of 2001. It's by Seymour Hersh, and it's called Annals of National Security, King's Ransom, and it's about the Saudis. Talking about National Security Agency intercepts of Saudi royal family communications, the intercepts have demonstrated to analysts that by 1996, Saudi money was supporting Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda and other extremist groups in Afghanistan, Lebanon, Yemen, and Central Asia, and throughout the Persian Gulf region. Quote, 96 is the key year, one American intelligence official told me. Bin Laden hooked up to all the bad guys. It's like the Grand Alliance and had a capability for conducting large-scale operations, unquote. The Saudi regime, he said, had, quote, gone to the dark side, unquote. Now, I would add, taking a look at an item that will anticipate some of the discussion in the second half of the program, reflecting back on discussions in past programs, and also looking ahead to some of the material we'll be covering next week and in succeeding weeks, we're going to review one of the key elements in the Afghan support effort that saw the genesis of Osama bin Laden and also World Trade Center 1 attack mastermind Ramzi Youssef. It was the anti-Soviet Afghan war that saw their genesis as warriors, and in turn, the one of the key elements in that was the World Muslim Congress, founded by SS Major Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and an associate of Ibn Saud, among others. And we're going to take a look at the intersection between the World Muslim Congress, as we've seen, Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Saudi elite, the Saudi royal family, and American neo-Nazis. Based in Pakistan, the World Muslim Congress was initially headed by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who, like his friend H. Keith Thompson, stood by the Third Reich until his death in 1974. A few years later, the World Muslim Congress, then headed by Pakistani Dr. Inamullah Khan, mailed Holocaust denial literature to every member of the U.S. Congress and the British Parliament. The World Muslim Congress's official mouthpiece, Muslim World, carried ads for the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and Henry Ford's The International Jew, skipping down. Dr. Khan also served as an advisor to the Saudi Arabian royal family, which lavished funds on the World Muslim Congress. In addition, the Saudi Arabian government retained the services of American neo-Nazi William Grimstead as a Washington lobbyist. Skipping down. After the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979, the World Muslim Congress began working closely with U.S. intelligence and Pakistani military officials who were covertly supporting the Afghan Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet-installed regime in Kabul. This effort was strongly endorsed by Dr. Khan, who served for many years as the Pakistani representative of the Nazi-infested World Anti-Communist League, which played an important role in the Reagan administration's secret war in the Golden Crescent. That from the book The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee, published in hardcover by Little Brown, copyright 1997, and that's a passage that we've dealt with before. Turning once again to the New Yorker article that was authored by Seymour Hersh, again from the New Yorker of October 22nd of 2001, bear in mind that 15 of the 19 hijackers who were involved in the September 11th attacks were from Saudi Arabia. More than 100 of the 158 detainees at Camp X-Ray are Saudi. Bin Laden, of course, is from Saudi Arabia, and the day after the attacks, the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Sultan, hired a private jet and flew 12 members of the Bin Laden family out of the United States. They were based in Boston, where the two planes that attacked the World Trade Center took off from. This was before the FBI could question them, and at a time when nobody else could fly. The air traffic in the United States was shut down. Assessing a diplomat's view of the Saudi relationship to the United States, Seymour Hersh writes, quote, "The Saudis have been so indulged for so many decades. They are spoiled. They've always had it their way. There's hardly anything we could say that would impede the majestic instancy of their progress. We're their janissaries," unquote. The diplomat was referring to the captives who became elite troops of the Ottoman Empire. And that again from the Seymour Hersh New Yorker article. Looking ahead to the second half of the program, San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, February 2nd of the year 2002, has an article by James Dow of the New York Times. It's headlined, "Bush Wants $120 Billion Budget Boost for the Pentagon." First paragraph, "In a military buildup rivaling that of the Reagan era, the Bush administration will call for increasing the Pentagon's yearly budget by $120 billion over the next 5 years to $451 billion in 2007, according to Defense Department documents. What we're going to be looking at in the second half of this program is nation building in the United States by some of the modern successors to this axis that we've been looking at in part one. We're going to be taking a look at the huge buildup for the war on terror and the Bush family's own connections to the Bin Laden family will be reviewed in the second half of the broadcast. We're going to take a look at this military outlay as not only an example of nation building in the United States. The Democratic Silicon Valley is going to be heavily focused in creating high-tech equipment for the war on terror. Southern California is going to get a huge outlay for the missile shield, which has gotten a boost from the attacks. This is also going to put the United States well over into the realm of deficit funding, when the Bush tax cuts kick in, and that basically is going to be deep doo-doo for the United States. Now, I've alluded to other programs that are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. In the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there will be an annotated, detailed description of For the Record program number 346 within a couple of days or 3 days of this broadcast. That website is at www.spitfirelist, one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com. Look in the For the Record section. In the description for 346, there will be links to two websites run by sister station WFMU, which have, for all intents and purposes, the whole For the Record series online. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 346, Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire, Nation Building by the Underground Reich. This is being recorded on February 3rd of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Hello, my name's Dave Emery. This is For the Record program number 346, part 2. The title is Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire, segment 3, Nation Building by the Underground Reich. And this is being recorded on February 3rd of 2002, and I apologize for having a cold. We're going to continue with our analysis of the September 11th, 2001 attacks as, at a domestic level, constituting a Reichstag fire. At an international level, it does indeed constitute a Pearl Harbor attack, a sneak attack upon the sovereign nation of the United States by a hostile foreign power, the Underground Reich. But since that Underground Reich is also installed in a powerful way in the corridors of power in this country, it also is functioning to a considerable extent like a Reichstag fire. we're going to take a look at what I call nation building in the United States by this underground Reich, elements of which we reviewed in the first half of the program. Turning now to the San Francisco Chronicle on Saturday, February 2nd of the year 2002, we're going to take a look at a section of an article from the New York Times. This is by James Dow, DAO, headlined, Bush wants a $120 billion budget boost for Pentagon. Bear in mind that, as we looked at in For the Record 214 and also in 337, collusion between the Saudis and the elder Bush through the intelligence community helped to create the, quote, oil shortage, unquote, that helped to defeat Jimmy Carter in 1980 by creating economic distress. It also served as the rationale for a huge military buildup, which basically tripled the American national debt in 8 years. That is going to cause serious long-term problems for the U.S. economy. Clinton was able to whittle that down to a certain extent, at least the budget deficits. But now we are going to be looking at a huge increase in defense spending, which, if the Bush tax cuts kick into effect on schedule, and he has implored that those be done, that is going to create huge budget deficits for the United States, further aggravating the situation of the national debt, putting the United States in serious trouble as the euro, which figures to be a relatively weak currency, thereby working against American manufactured exports, cuts into the dollar status as a reserve currency. And it is by borrowing against the dollars that are held in reserve by other countries that we have managed to avoid many of the serious effects of the Reagan-Bush debt. I would also note that the Saudis hold a considerable portion of our foreign debt. Now, turning to this article by James Dow of the New York Times, running the Chronicle, in a military buildup rivaling that of the Reagan era, the Bush administration will call for increasing the Pentagon's yearly budget by $120 billion over the next 5 years, to $451 billion in 2007, according to Defense Department documents. By the end of the five-year period, spending to purchase weapons and other military supplies alone would swell to $99 billion a year from $61 billion this year. Spending on personnel, operations, and research programs also would grow, but not as fast. Well, I look at this military buildup at several different levels. In the first place, I would look at the September 11th attacks, which have served as a pretext for this military buildup, as basically providing an occasion for military Keynesianism. As I'm speaking on February 3rd of 2002, the country is in a serious recession. In fact, the whole world is in a serious recession. Gas prices mysteriously rose in the year 2000, helping to burst America's speculative economic bubble and defeat Al Gore, at least ostensibly defeat Al Gore. I would note that the rise in defense spending and counterterrorism spending is going to have a number of different effects. First of all, it will be turning the Silicon Valley, a stronghold of Clinton-Gore economic or political power, toward fighting the war on terror. This may very well turn this area Republican. At least I suspect that is the intent. There are going to be huge outlays for the missile defense system for the aerospace industry in Southern California. California and New York were the two big states that went for Al Gore in the year 2000. I suspect that with counterterrorism, high-tech spending in the Silicon Valley, and aerospace spending in Southern California through the Missile Defense Shield, there is an intent to turn, basically to accomplish some nation-building, Republican-slash-underground Reich nation-building in the state of California. I would also note that New York has been seriously depressed as a result of the September 11th attacks, New York City. Rudy Giuliani is emerging on the national stage, and in a future broadcast, we're going to take a look at Rudy's connections to the Iran-Contra machinations. One of the things to keep in mind is the possibility that Rudy may emerge on the national stage. Who knows, perhaps even as a vice presidential candidate if Dick Cheney has to resign over the Enron scandal. That's just a thing to keep in mind. Now, In addition to helping to change California, perhaps, to a Republican bent, so to speak, bear in mind that throughout the country, the economy is depressed, and in effect, what we're going to be doing is borrowing on the future to have a huge defense buildup around the country. This, I suspect, constitutes Bush's economic recovery program. Basically, what Reagan's program was, which is to put the United States even farther in debt and to put people to work on defense projects, thereby keeping them happy and making them Republican, at least in the short term. Now, when the Republican, when the tax cuts that were passed in 2001 kick in, and many of them won't kick in for a few years, that is going to put the United States in a serious, serious budget deficit situation if, in fact, this defense spending increases. If Bush is able to do what he wants, which is to emulate the Ronald Reagan defense buildup. With the euro now in effect and probably going to be a relatively weak currency, it certainly is so far, that will not only increase the cost of American manufactured exports, thereby weakening or weakening their market value abroad because people won't be able to afford them, but it also, the euro that is going to be cutting into the dollar status as a reserve currency. That is the only thing that kept us from economic disaster under Ronald Reagan, was basically the fact that we were borrowing against the number of dollars held as reserve currency. But with all of Europe using one currency, that is going to cut into the dollar status. I suspect that the Bormann Organization and the Underground Reich, which I believe manipulate George Bush, I think that George Bush is in effect a puppet. I don't think he has any real power. The combination of the Bush projected military spending and the tax cuts and the euro's effect on the dollar's status as a reserve currency will spell economic disaster for the United States. I think that, in effect, we're going to become the Saudi states of Argentina at some point in the future. I think this is designed by the Underground Reich to ultimately undermine the American economic and social fabric, perhaps precipitating martial law, certainly crashing the United States. I think that in the short term, this will also put Americans to work on defense projects, thereby giving the Republicans the credit for the economic salvation, at least in the short term, of the United States. And I've noted the probable impact on California, where Gray Davis is already under fire because of the energy crisis that we had in California. I've done programs about the energy crisis in the past, specifically for the Record 280. It appears to have been deliberately created by the major energy traders, including the late not-so-great Enron Corporation. Now, more about Bush's economic program and some of the beneficiaries, bearing in mind the Saudi petrodollar connections that we've spoken about in the past. In For the Record 329 and in For the Record 334 and 337, we spoke about the Carlyle Group. We came back to that in For the Record 342. Carlyle is a large and very mysterious, relatively secretive, I should say, equity company with very profound connections to people from the Reagan and Bush administrations, also very powerful personages abroad. There are many powerful Saudi investors in Carlyle Group, formerly including members of the Bin Laden family and including members of the Bin Mahfouz family. Khalid Bin Mahfouz was one of the principal figures in the BCCI scandal, and the Bin Mahfouz family, like the Bin Laden family, were represented in North America by James R. Bath, who helped to capitalize George W.'s first energy company. In all probability, the money for Arbusto Energy came from Bass wealthy Saudi clients, including in all likelihood the Bin Ladens and or the Bin Mahfouzes. I would note that Khalid Bin Mahfouz, whom we're going to come back to later, is married to Osama Bin Laden's sister. Now, of the Carlyle Group, and again, think about nation building in the United States. Also think about the title to this op-ed column by the New York Times very observant economic columnist, Paul Krugman. This is from the New York Times of Tuesday, January 15th of 2002. It's headlined, Crony Capitalism, USA, and it reads in part as follows. And the business magazine Red Herring has published the biggest expose to date of the secretive Carlyle Group, an investment company whose story sounds like the plot of a bad TV series. Carlyle specializes in buying down-and-out defense contractors, then reselling them when their fortunes miraculously improve after they receive new government business. Among the company's employees is former President George H.W. Bush. Among the group's investors until late October was the Bin Laden family of Saudi Arabia. Another administration would have regarded the elder Bush's role at Carlyle as unseemly. This administration apparently does not. And Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld recently gave his old college wrestling partner Frank Carlucci, head of Carlyle, a very nice gift. Mr. Rumsfeld decided to proceed with the much-criticized Crusader artillery system, which even the Pentagon wanted to cancel. The result was another turnaround for a Carlyle-owned company, and again, the Bin Mahfouz's involved in that. So take a look at the, or consider, I should say, the Bush-Pentagon spending increase as not only nation-building in the United States, but also crony capitalism USA, with Bush's Saudi associates slash masters, question mark, as co-participants in this program of nation-building, as well as crony capitalism. Also consider some of the other aspects of George Bush's public policy as, in effect, crony capitalism as well. And also consider the involvement, or perhaps possible involvement in this case, or in impending involvement, of key members of the Saudi elite. We're going to turn now to an article researched for us by a member of the listening audience. This comes from Newsweek's issue of February 4th of the year 2002. The Periscope column has an article by Michael Isikoff of Newsweek called Neil Bush's Saudi Business Connection. Last week, in For the Record 345, we spoke about a recent conference in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, the headquarters of the Bin Laden family, and we talked about the fact that they had been sponsoring a conference about American-Saudi business relations. That conference was the focal point of this Periscope column. What was Neil Bush doing in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia last week? Officially, the president's youngest brother was a keynote speaker at an international business forum. Among the main backers of the event, the Saudi Bin Laden Construction Company and Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, the tycoon whose $10 million offer to help the victims of the World Trade Center attacks was rejected last fall by New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. With an audience filled with Saudi royals, Bush talked about the role of public opinion, unquote, in shaping U.S. Mideast policy. But Bush's main purpose wasn't public relations advice. Newsweek has learned that the presidential sibling also had another agenda, recruiting Middle East investors for an educational software firm that, industry sources say, may benefit enormously from the new $26.5 billion education bill signed by President George W. Bush. Neil Bush's Austin-based firm called Ignite has raised about $18 million since last year, mostly from foreign investors in Japan, Taiwan, and the Middle East, said Ignite executive Kenneth Leonard. The company is exploring joint ventures with computer software firms in Dubai and is seeking contracts with the United Arab Emirates Ministry of Education and other foreign governments, said Leonard, who has accompanied Bush on three trips to the Mideast since George W. became president. Neil Bush's business career has created problems for his family in the past. In 1990, while his father was president, he was reprimanded by federal regulators for his role as a director of the failed Silverado Savings and Loan. Bush told Newsweek he has avoided contacting U.S. officials during his recent travels and said there was nothing improper about his seeking business from foreign governments. What am I supposed to do? Nothing in life? Unquote. We noted in the past Prince Al-Walid's connections to, among others, Silvio Berlusconi, the Prime Minister of Italy, and a former member of Licio Gelli's P2 Lodge. I've also noted in the past, specifically in 345, that the Bin Laden family helped to sponsor this particular conference. And through the aforementioned Carlyle Group and the aforementioned Arbusto Energy, there are business connections, petrodollar connections, between the Bin Ladens and the Bushes, and I've spoken about that many times in the past. In addition to this type of crony capitalism, I would note that some of the Saudi American and Saudi worldwide business connections, and specifically some of the connections to the Bin Laden family, appear to have helped to generate political heat on Bill Clinton in the past. Now, what we're going to look at now is not only the attacks on the U.S. embassies in August of 1998 as a means of helping to frustrate rapprochement between the U.S. and the government of Sudan at the time. We're also going to look at the use of these particular attacks and the manipulation of the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical firm in order to discredit Bill Clinton, to discredit Bill Clinton in the United States abroad, to discredit him with the American left, who were led by Ramsey Clark in their attacks on Bill Clinton for the Al-Shifa. We're also going to take a look at a very cynical manipulation by the Underground Reich, and I believe, perhaps incorrectly, that the Underground Reich runs the Bush administration, that they also run Saudi Arabia, and in all likelihood the Bin Ladens. We're also going to take a look at Underground Reich / international fascist connections to the Israeli right. And we're going to take a look at a truly Machiavellian manipulation of not only the Israeli right, but also Bill Clinton, and also the Middle East peace process. We're going to review information from, For the Record 343, from the book Dollars for Terror, that was authored by Richard LaBeviere and translated by Martin Demare. It was published in softcover by Algora Publishing, copyright 2000 in English. It was originally published in 1999 in French, ISBN 1-892941-06-6. Now bear in mind that as the attacks on the American embassies took place on 8/7/98, Bill Clinton was facing impeachment over the Monica Lewinsky imbroglio. Keep that in mind, because what we're going to be looking at here constitutes what could be considered a pincers movement. Talking about Clinton's response to the attacks, on August 20th, cruise missiles hit several military camps in Afghanistan and an industrial plant in Sudan. The religious guide of the Islamist regime of Khartoum, Hassan el-Turabi, who had been seeking a rapprochement with the United States, was attracting lightning bolts from the regime's hawks. It was to thwart his initiative that they, with the assistance of Bin Laden, had financed and organized the two attacks of August 7th. FBI investigations revealed several connections between the CIA and the Saudi billionaires' networks. Bin Ladengate was underway, causing a wave of protest in the Arab world. The American response only confirmed Islamism in its distrust toward the West. Now, the official version had it upon investigation that, in fact, the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical firm was not involved in making chemical weapons, but that was not, in fact, the case. That was to discredit Clinton and the U.S. Turning to Dollars for Terror, an expert from the French Defense Ministry brought some clarity to that debate by concluding that the factory could have produced chemical ingredients which individually remain inert, but which joined together might go into the design of a weapon of mass destruction. These ingredients are organophosphors. Skipping down again, this class of poisons in a liquid state close to that of oil appeared in the 1950s. They can be used to manufacture the composition of the toxic agent VX. VX, in very small amounts, causes a lethal cutaneous reaction, explains Jacques Isnau. And, skipping down again, the scandal caused by the bombing of the Al-Shifa factory is not a diplomatic game, unquote, says the former governor of the Bank of Sudan. Quote, you should find out who bought the factory, for he is a central character in the political conflict that is dividing the central power, unquote. A Saudi of Sudanese origin, the new owner of the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical complex, is the businessman Salah el-Din Ahmed Idris, right-hand man to an important Saudi financier. He saved him $600 million during the Islamic Bank scandal, BCCI. Close to the Saudi monarchy, Idris is related to bin Laden through one of his wives. By the way, the Saudi financier alluded to here is the aforementioned Khalid bin Mahfouz of BCCI fame, and he apparently was deeply involved in the ownership of the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical firm. He also is part of the Bush family slash Saudi financial and industrial axis, and it was the ambiguity of the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical plant, initially believed to be manufacturing chemical weapons, then allegedly not involved, that ultimately served to help to discredit Bill Clinton abroad and at home. We're going to take a look now at an element of the foreign criticism against Bill Clinton, and here we're going to take a look once again at the convergence of the foreign policy and domestic aspect of the this particular attack. In addition, the Muslim Brotherhood, by the way, parenthetically, that we looked at in 343, condemned the American attacks in a press statement declaring that they were, quote, a diversion from the scandals confronting the President of the United States, unquote, referring to the President's sordid affair with a White House intern, Monica Lewinsky. In the past, we've looked at a number of interesting connections not only between international fascism and the Israeli right, but between elements of the American right and the Israeli right as well. Among those broadcasts are the lecture L8, miscellaneous archive shows M30 and M58, also for the record program 94 and number 252. What I want listeners to consider is one of the things that we looked at in For the Record 139, which was that there appeared to have been links between the Monica Lewinsky scandal and attempts to control Clinton by elements of the Israeli intelligence that were associated with the Israeli right. In this same time period, the Republican right and Newt Gingrich were working to undermine Bill Clinton with regard to the Mideast process by A, disagreeing with the Clinton administration and Yitzhak Rabin by endorsing the Israeli rights proposal to establish Jerusalem as the Israeli capital in place of Tel Aviv. And also then, when the Monica Lewinsky scandal was heating up, Newt Gingrich traveled to Israel and addressed the Knesset in a similar fashion. I would note that Benjamin Netanyahu and the Likud party have strong connections to the fascist element within the Zionist movement. Again, that discussed in numerous miscellaneous archive shows and a number of For the Record programs. One of the things to consider is Bill Clinton as being the focal point of a pincers movement with the Underground Reich, which controls elements of the Israeli right that we've looked at in some of the shows that I've enumerated, For the Record 94, 139, and 252, and miscellaneous archive shows M30 and M58. And consider the manipulation of the Israeli peace process. In For the Record 334 and in number 337 and 340, we took a look at the fact that many of the moderate Palestinians who were serving as the Palestinian negotiating team were in fact protégés of James Baker, who had been coached in the latest PR techniques by the CIA. Those were dubbed Baker's Dozen by the agency. At the same time as the candidacy of Ehud Barak was undermined when Yasser Arafat walked out of the peace negotiations at Camp David, that doomed the Gore candidacy. Had Clinton negotiated a Middle East peace, that would have been a huge boost for Al Gore. That also torpedoed the Israeli progressive and peace movement and Ehud Barak, who had staked his political life on a successful peace negotiation. And with the Republican right tied to the Saudis and to bin Laden and to Al-Qaeda, to elements of the intelligence community, and with some of the above-abbreviated connections to the Israeli right, in turn with connections to international fascism, consider the domestic peace situation as an example of nation-building, the undermining of the Clinton candidacy through the manipulation of Islamic fundamentalism and the Israeli right wing. We're going to conclude our discussion in this broadcast by taking a look at a book that I used in Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, Uncle Sam and the Swastika. This book is called All Honorable Men. It's authored by James Stewart Martin, who was in charge of the Economic Warfare Section of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice in World War II. It was published in hardcover by Little Brown and Company of Boston, copyright 1950. This particular book was authored by the man who was in charge with investigating the U.S.-German industrial connections, of which the Bush family that we looked at in the first half of the program were an intimate part, an integral part, I should say. And bear in mind that it was these connections that James Stewart Martin was investigating. He concluded his 300-page text, All Honorable Men, with the following observations. The eco-political masters of Germany boosted Hitler and his program into the driver's seat at a time when the tide in the political fight between the Nazis and the supporters of the Weimar Republic was swinging against the Nazis. All of the men who mattered in banking and industrial circles could quickly agree on one program and throw their financial weight behind it. Their support won the election for the Nazis. We must assume that the same thing is not yet true in the United States. Bear in mind he was writing in 1950. We do have economic power so concentrated that it would lie in the power of a group of not more than 100 men, if they could agree among themselves, to throw the same kind of combined economic weight behind a single program. They have not agreed yet, skipping down. If the United States should run into serious economic difficulties, however, most of the conditions for a reenactment of the German drama would already exist on the American stage. The slight differences within the camp of the fraternity then may be the only real barrier to the kind of integration of the financial and industrial community behind a single repressive program like that which the financiers and industrialists of Germany executed through Hitler. Are we safe in assuming that it would take a grave economic crisis to precipitate the dangers inherent in economic concentration? The basic integration of the financial and industrial groups in the United States is evident when we look at the increase of concentration in the past few years. Skipping down again. Martin concluded his 300-page book with the following paragraph. The moral of this is not that Germany is an inevitable menace, but that there are forces in our own country which can make Germany a menace. And, more importantly, they could create a menace of their own here at home, not through a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe, but as a calm judgment of business necessity, unquote. The men who would do this are not Nazis, but businessmen. Not criminals, but honorable men. That was James Stewart Martin writing in 1950, and in the column that we excerpted earlier, Paul Krugman wrote the following in 2002. It was CBS Market Watch's executive editor, not some whining political commentator, who warned that, quote, a small group of business leaders exert enormous clout over Bush and his team in getting the rules changed to their benefit, unquote. That concludes For the Record 346, Part 2, Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire, Segment 3, Nation Building by the Underground Reich, being recorded on February 3rd of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.